Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott. This is Welcome to Florida. I think of the old, you know, those old theater signs that would have one mask with the smile and one mask with the agony and the tear. Well, we're going to get to the smile and Dave Barry later on, but being Florida, we don't have all good news to share. And Craig's most recent Florida Phoenix column goes into more detail on an issue you've really tried highlighting time and time and time again, and that's the safety of outdoor workers, of which there are so many: construction, highway, you know, landscaping in this state in a time of climate change.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, as we saw this summer, climate change is just getting worse. It's not getting better. Mm-hmm. And Florida's bearing the brunt of it. And the people who are really, you know, really sort of catching the heat, so to speak, are the outdoor workers who have to be out there experiencing those incredibly high temperatures, the droughts, yeah, and so forth. And the legislature decided in its infinite wisdom that no local government, no county, no city is allowed to do anything for these folks to try and protect them. They can't require employers to give people water breaks. They can't require any sort of limitation on their hours, can't require them to let their people go into the shade. So basically, it's open season on outdoor workers, according to the legislature.
It's barbaric. At the same time, the Florida State High School Athletic Association mandates water breaks in high school football games. But for, you know, adults, it's okay to work on an asphalt surface 8 hours a day in 100 degrees, but it's not okay for the municipality to say, you know what, maybe give these guys 20 minutes at 3:30 in the afternoon, yeah, to, you know, wring their shirt out and put on a dry set of clothes. This is cruelty as a policy. There is no good reason to prevent humanity. And again, the state is not saying, you know, it's forbidding a local municipality. You know, if Amelia Island or St. Petersburg or Gainesville or some county wanted to do, they're preventing the municipalities from doing this.
Right. And the state has no rules on this, and the feds don't either. OSHA has a set of guidelines, but they're just recommendations. They're not any requirements. So basically, those poor outdoor workers they're up the creek, so to speak.
Well, it makes them feel disposable.
Yeah.
Like they're almost, you know, cannon fodder for the economy. Well, I mean, mm-hmm, these guys, I guess they should have, what? The next thinking is going to be, well, if they didn't want that job, go to college, or, you know, been raised white or something, or been raised middle class where you could have options and didn't have to hammer on a roof all day. You think it's hot in your lawn? Go up on your roof. Oh, where that tar is reflecting back, you know, the sunlight when you've got the guys up there, you know, putting it is absolutely barbaric. And there's a wonderful reporter, journalist, Jason Garcia is his name.
Yeah. He's terrific. I'm a big fan.
A newsletter about Florida politics I recently came across. It's called Seeking Rents. And along with Craig's Florida Phoenix column, I'm going to put this down in the show notes. But he ran down some of the legislative actions that have been passed on to the governor for signature and conversion into law. And there's no reason to believe the governor is not going to okay any of these. Now, Craig, you and I focus a lot on environmental and conservation issues. And while the worst of the proposed measures out of the legislature regarding conservation were defeated, in addition to the "to hell with the outdoor workers" bill, how about a bill loosening child labor laws and allowing businesses to employ teenagers for longer hours? Of course, we've got the bill allowing people to shoot black bears if they feel threatened. Now, that may be in a subdivision and a guy popping off with a 44 Magnum at night. Who knows what's behind him?
And the legislator who was backing that claimed that it's because there were bears on crack, which, of course, is the complete fantasy. Bears. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Here's one. Again, another bill to limit the power of cities and counties to regulate homes rented out on platforms like Airbnb. This is one of the issues that is driving housing prices up so much. Big investors coming in and buying housing and turning it into short-term rental. It's another bill that the party that is supposed to favor home rule is taking away home rule. just like your heat bill. A bill would erase local living wage laws. You know, why would anyone need to live on their wage? However, at the same time, we want to impose longer prison sentences on shoplifters.
Yeah.
That's a priority. House Bill 549, longer. No one should be going to prison for shoplifting. Another one here. Bill would limit the power of cities and counties to independently investigate and discipline police misconduct.
Yeah.
Bill would allow home builders to employ more 16 and 17-year-old teenagers on residential construction. Well, that's exactly what we need. More teenagers working longer hours on construction site. At the same time, House Bill 931, the bill would allow school districts to let religious chaplains counsel students in public schools. So that separation of church and state, not interested.
And the Satanic Temple has already expressed an interest in sending some chaplains in. So we'll see how that pans out.
I'm sure they didn't have that in mind. This bill would allow, the bill would allow House Bill 1347. The bill would allow consumer loan companies that target lower income borrowers to charge higher interest rates. This is a loan sharking bill.
Yeah,
this is a pro loan sharking bill.
Yeah, and the legislature was in favor of that. Yeah.
Bill 1365 would effectively make it illegal for homeless people to sleep on public property in Florida.
Yeah.
You put them in
these camps, but they didn't provide any money for the local governments to set up the camps. So
Well, here's another one. The bill would expand last year's Senate Bill 170, empowering people and businesses to block new land development restrictions from local governments. So if you want to block land development restrictions, have at it. This bill would reduce Senate Bill 1645 would reduce regulations on natural gas pipelines, prohibit offshore wind energy, and erase most mentions of climate change from state law.
Yeah, which I wrote about a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
And on, this is important legislation. House Bill 503 would prevent local communities. Again, prevent local communities. So this is taking away home rule by the party that's supposed to favor home rule and limited government. Prevent local communities from imposing restrictions on gas-powered leaf blowers. Well, folks, we have got one hell of a society if gas-powered leaf blowers are at the top of the agenda for the Florida State Legislature.
Well, I think it's safe to say our representatives aren't representing us. So,
Seeking Rents, I will put a link to that in the show notes and as well as Craig's column. All right. This has been someone... Craig has pursued as a guest on the podcast ever since we began back in 2020. The great Dave Barry, 1988 Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary. He was a Miami Herald columnist from 1983 until 2005. His column was syndicated at one point in 500 different publications. He's had a sitcom based on his life, countless books. DaveBarry.com. The New York Times called him the funniest man in America, and he joins us today.
I have wanted to have Dave on for quite a while, but he's very much in demand. It's hard to get any of his time. But fortunately, he wrote another book, which he does pretty regularly. And so I suggested that maybe he'd like to come on our podcast and promote it. And when I went on, I ran into him at the Key West Literary Seminar and reminded him of that. And he said, okay, you've worn me down. And instead of filing stalking charges, I'll go ahead and agree. So that's why he's here today.
Bravo to you. And thanks for Dave. And this is a real high watermark in the history of the show. So without any more tap dancing, here we go. The great Dave Barry.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to this. I have to tell you, I really enjoyed Swamp Story. It is the finest novel featuring a time traveling chiropractor I've ever read.
I know it's kind of a cliche, the time traveling chiropractor. You know, you think Melville, you think Dostoevsky, but I think I took it to a different level
or a different era. Yeah. Could you write books like that if you lived in a different state?
I've never written a novel in a different state or one set in a different state, so it's hard to say. No, probably not. I mean, the thing is, like I like to say, and this is my good friend Carl Hiaasen, who's the greatest of the living Florida novelists, is always saying, and it's I cannot dispute it. Generally, anything when you write a novel, you're trying to imagine things, and you try to imagine things that are weird and different, at least if you're writing a comic novel. And as Carl was always saying, you can't really think of anything that Florida isn't weirder than, you know, already. So that frees you when you're writing about this state to just go where your imagination wants, you know, whatever scenario, ludicrous scenario you cook up. You think, well, that probably could happen here. And I do think most of the things that I have happened in Swamp Story could happen in Florida, could not happen anywhere else. So to answer your question, short answer is probably not. I don't think I could set a novel like this in any other state.
I read somewhere that you're now working on a memoir. Does that start with your birth, or do you go back further than that?
it starts with my birth. But it's weird. It's a weird experience writing a memoir, especially for me, I think, because my persona is in print is not a guy who presents himself as having a lot of important things to say. I always say people come away from things I've written, feel, you know, if anything, stupider than when they went in. So it's not like I have wisdom to impart, and so what do I have to impart? Like I can tell stories about, you know, my life, but is my life really that interesting compared to anybody else's life? I don't know. It just feels a little arrogant, I guess, and pretentious for me to be writing a memoir. I'd even like the word, but I'm trying to make it funny. So I hope that works. I hope it's accessible, even if people don't learn anything from it, which they probably won't.
Will you be looking back at episodes of Dave's World for research?
No, Dave's World was a highly inaccurate representation of my life. I think, you know, when they bought the rights to do that, first of all, I never should have let them name the character Dave Barry. I mean, that should have been, because that the impression it created in the viewers was that this was, you know, my life. You know, Harry Anderson was playing me. And right there, you've got a problem, because he's like at least was a foot taller than I am.
Yeah.
And
blonde.
And blonde. And when they bought the rights, they bought a collection of columns. And if you look at my columns, they didn't have a point to them, and they didn't have a plot. There was no learning or, you know, character growth or anything like any of the things we associate usually with, you know, dramas of some kind. I think they realized that pretty quickly on. So they kind of created this world, Dave's World, where this guy is supposedly a humor columnist in Miami, which I really was. But you're a writer, Craig. You know this. You don't. If you were to like film a writer in his day to day life, it would be so unbelievably boring.
Yeah.
It's like it's a person sitting in front of a screen going, "Well, this is no good." And that's really most that's your day.
Is this where I put the booger in the first mission?
Yeah,
of
yeah.
Is
yeah, exactly. Yeah. They had to kind of create a plot, and the plot would, you know, be things, you know, neighbors showing up and weird things happening. And that doesn't happen in you know, most writers' real lives. They just, like I said, they sit there and write. So they had to sort of create this plot and yet still present him as a writer. And the way they would do that is they had Harry Anderson walking around with a manila envelope that represented a column. And like, again, you're a writer. This is not how you don't, there's no manila envelope. Like, and my colleagues at the Miami Herald thought this was hilarious. And when I go in there, they say, "Dave, where's the column?" You know? And that was like, oh, you know, part of the plot points is Dave was always late with his column, and where's his column? And just to remind you that he has a column. But anyway, I can't even remember what your question was, Craig. But it was about
your memoir.
My memoir, yeah. Oh, the answer is I haven't even gotten to mention Dave's World. I guess I'll have to at some point in my memoir that I did have a sitcom named for me for 4 years back in the 90s. It seems like a long time ago now.
You're very well known for your humor, obviously, for your writing funny. You moved to Florida in 1983. When did you realize that Florida was funny?
Actually, I moved in 1986. The Herald, oh, okay. The Miami Herald hired me in 1983. I lived in this bucolic little town, Glen Mills, Pennsylvania. And I said, I'm absolutely, and I would love to take the job, but I'm not moving to Florida, I'm not moving to Miami. I had visited Miami to write a column for Tropic Magazine. And they offered me the job. And when I got to Miami in 1983, it was crazy. It was, you know, the you know, the cocaine cowboys wars, the riot, they just had a bunch of riots. The Mariel Boatlift had just happened. And they gave me no guidance. Gene Weingarten, Tropic Magazine editors, and, you know, near rent a car and just drive around, which was crazy. You know, like Miami was not. And I drove back to, you know, to Glen Mills, Pennsylvania. And I said, I'm never going to move a family down. That's crazy. So in 1983, they said, well, you're just writing humor anyway, so you can
be funny anywhere.
You can be funny. Yeah. So you can stay there and be a columnist for the Miami Herald. And that was the original agreement. And then over the next few years, I would come down to Miami every few months to write feature articles and just to meet, you know, see the people at the Herald and whatever. And I got to see more of the city and just get more into it. And after a while, I realized, first of all, that I could live here, that there were places that, you know, in Miami that you wouldn't necessarily get shot at every day. And second, that it was really an amazing place. I mean, that there's just so much going on that was just not like, certainly not like Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, but really not like anywhere else. There was kind of a rich source, great source of material, especially humor material. And so after 3 years, I decided voluntarily to leave bucolic Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, and move to Miami. And I've been here ever since. And I love it here now, but that's how it happened. It was like, Miami had to kind of win me over.
Did you know that family travel has the incredible power to shape our children's worldview and create lasting memories? In a world where representation is often lacking, it's essential for our children to see themselves reflected in every aspect of life, including the stories we tell about travel. Introducing the Travel of Legacy podcast, where we're rewriting the script by celebrating the diverse voices of Black and Brown family travelers. Each episode of Travel of Legacy is a testament to the enriching power and the joy of exploration in Black and Brown communities. So journey with us and subscribe now.
That's amazing, because one of my other questions was going to be, what were your first impressions? And you obviously answered that. It took you 3 years to figure out I could conceivably live there.
This is literally true. When I was driving my rental car around, when I first got here the first time, I saw a car go by with holes in the side, which I was later informed by a Miami Herald photographer were bullet holes. And he said, oh, yeah, you'll see that from time to time. Again, not something you would see in a car in Glen Mills, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, I have to say one of the early things that you wrote for the Herald, wrote for Tropic, it was so funny. It's the funniest newspaper story I've ever read. And I saved a copy. I still have it. Mm-hmm. It's from the 1986 campaign of Bob Graham versus Paula Hawkins.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely hysterical, where you describe Bob Graham as being as spontaneous as highway construction.
Yes. that was so much fun to write. I mean, that was a hilarious campaign. Paula Hawkins was in her own way. She wasn't trying to be funny, but she was a very funny senator.
Yeah.
And I mean, she was a very controlled person, and she detested the press. I mean, loathed. It was mutual. It was very mutual. Because the press was always presenting her as kind of ditzy. And I think that the term that the reporters used was Betty Boop. She was kind of perky. You know, she hated that. Hated the reporters. It was just And then Bob Graham was the governor. Well, he became one of my favorite politicians of all time. He won that election. But he was this really boring human being who was in his own little way crazy. I mean, deep inside, Bob Graham has sort of a kind of a lunatic streak, which he held tightly under control because he was presenting himself as a responsible United States senator. But when he got elected, it was so good for me. I spent time with both campaigns writing that piece you're talking about. Although it was with Paula Hawkins, it was like you'd get, if you spent a whole day following her campaign around, you might get 30 seconds of talking to Paula Hawkins. She just didn't want any part. Bob Graham, we rode in the plane with him. We rode in the van with him. He'd show up at the bar. He was just always around. So we became sort of friends. And when he became a senator, I found that I could ask him anything. I could, and I did. I would see like an, I remember once I wrote a, I was writing a column about accordion repair. Somebody had sent me a news item. They think the last accordion repair shop in the United States was closing. And, you know, the accordion community was upset about this. And I called Bob Graham's office, and Ken, I can't remember, Ken Klein was his press secretary. And Ken Klein was also a little crazy, would put me right through to Dave Barry's on the phone with a question about accordion repair. And whatever else he was doing, he would drop it and he would talk to me. And I'd say, Bob, and he would not know, of course, what I was calling about. I'd say, Senator Graham, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the, you know, the last accordion repair shop in the United States is closing. And he goes, Bob, and you go, Dave, of course, we're aware of this. We're very concerned about this. Now that we're going to be dependent upon a foreign accordion repair. And he would give me this perfect United States Senator ease answer. Anything I asked him about. And so I just loved him. I still love him. Every now and then I see him. And he always just had that going on. He was like, to the public, he presented himself as this, you know, very serious, responsible. Then he got elected every time. But he was secretly a little bit crazy also. So anyway, getting back to the story, I just had so much fun traipsing around the state with these two kind of strange individuals and writing about that race.
Well, it turned out well. I wish they had sent you out on every campaign, honestly.
What did you grow to like about Miami?
Well, it's first of all, I always say this, it's the least boring place I have ever lived. I mean, just, you know, weird things do routinely happen here. Some of them are scary weird, some of them are funny weird, but weird. And the two examples I often say, among the first things that I wrote about when I got here was a bale of cocaine falling from the sky into a Citizens Crime Watch meeting. Now,
and it just missed the police chief, right?
The chief of police, Kurt yes. Ivey in Homestead, could have killed him. And where else is that going to happen? You know, but that's sort of an extreme example. But because we have so many different cultures coming together here, you know, celebrities and tourists and, you know, hurricanes, and it's just things keep happening here. So it's just like never boring. And I like that. I'm also a big fan of Latin culture. My wife is Cuban Jewish. As in most of Miami is Latin, but I've come to love the Latin culture. It's kind of like, let's party, let's enjoy ourselves, whatever, we'll be fine. Well, there are some rules, but we're not going to follow all the rules. You know,
this is like, more of a guideline.
Yeah, right. And this is like how we drive. This is how our government operates. It's just kind of like more of a freelance kind of vibe down here. And I like that. And it is highly cosmopolitan. Like my neighbors they're from all over the world. And I think that's just kind of cool. What I always tell people is, if you are the kind of person when you travel who likes to be on a tour with a tour guide and a tour bus, and you have a seat on the tour bus, and you know they're going to take you to a good restaurant where it's safe, and they're going to take you to a good hotel where it's safe, and you're going to see all the important sites. You won't have to make a lot of decisions, but nothing is going to go wrong. You will not like Miami. You know, you'll like you'll like Orlando. That's, you know, if you like to just travel on your own and go into some places, yeah, you know, where maybe it's a little bit more dangerous, a little sketchy. You might find an amazing restaurant. You might get beat up. Like, you don't know. Then you like the kind of like take a chance. You know, not be so not have everything be cut and dried and decided in advance. You'll like Miami. It's more of that kind of a place.
I remember you you produced some bumper stickers to try and persuade tourists.
Yeah, I still have some. They say, "Come back to Miami. We weren't shooting at you." In fairness, now Miami is like when I got here in the 80s, it was pretty. I mean, there were parts of Miami that could be very dangerous. It's not really. It's not nearly like that as much as it was. I'm not saying it's like super safe, but it's more of a typical American city than
yeah, and that was going to be my next question. You've been there 40 years now. What have you seen as the greatest transformations, evolutions in the city?
it's really exploded. There are people moving here every day, more and more people moving, too many people. I mean, we have too many people here. It's too much traffic. But the whole downtown area, the skyline since I moved here is completely different. I mean, it's just high rise condos everywhere now, big store. And this is in some ways good. I mean, the economically, the city is vibrant. There are an incredible number of restaurants. Miami's a real food capital now. You know, if you want to go out to eat, this is an incredible place. It's also been rough for some people. The property values are very high. That's good for those of us who own houses. But if you want to buy a house here, it's really difficult now, very expensive. economically, it's changed in that way. I think it's a little bit more of a mature city than it was. It doesn't have quite the vibe of the old West, Wild West going on. Still, I mean, it's still a city that likes to party and likes to enjoy itself, but it feels a little more grown up than it used to when I first got here. Definitely doesn't feel as unsafe as it did when I first got here. It's kind of more of as a stabilized, I hate to say this because this is what the Chamber of Commerce is, but it feels more like a world-class city than it used to, more grown up.
And mm-hmm. and yet it's still insane city, to use the
it's still
title
crazy.
Of one, yeah. one of your novels.
Yeah, yeah. It is still insane, in a good way, and sometimes a bad way.
What are your favorite parts of the state outside of Miami?
Well, I like the Keys, where I saw my friend Craig just a couple months ago at the Key West Literary Seminar. There's like nothing like the Keys. It's always kind of amazing to me that I can just get in a car and drive to this chain of islands, like that, you know. That it feels like you drive through the 60s to get down to Key West, which is, you know, this little resort community. I like that a lot. I don't know. I still like Orlando. You know, I'm probably not split. It's probably uncool to say that, but I just went up there with my family, my kids and grandkids, and we all gathered at Disney World, you know, because that's what we
don't tell the governor.
I know. Yeah. I know. We're afraid that we're going to be converted to some kind of weird sex cult. But we got out. We got out just in time. But you know, like weird. I mean, you're not supposed to say it's uncool to say that you like Orlando. But my kids grew up going. I grew up taking them there. Now our grandkids are going there, and we still like it. We still enjoy that experience. So I like that, and. I did a book a couple of years ago called Best State Ever. I just drove around Florida and went to mostly old school tourist attractions like Weeki Wachee and
Gatorland.
And I just still kind of like that old Florida stuff.
That's actually my favorite book of yours. It's terrific. It really is.
Oh, thank you.
What prompted you to write that? I mean, what made you feel like I have to defend Florida?
Well, the defending Florida part was just more like a way to kind of set the, you know, give it a theme. But really what it was just like there are like, it's a kind of an extension of how I feel about Miami. It's a strange state, and it made its, you know, its living for so many years by kind of hucksterism and, you know, selling dreams and selling oddities. And there's still that's still going on, you know, that's. You know, in a way, that's what Orlando still is. It's just like, you know, come down here and have your fantasies come true. And but these older places like Weeki Wachee, where they, you know, that was going on in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. That just fascinates me. That's kind of the heritage of the state. So that's what I just wanted to go. Right. In fact, I could have done it a lot longer. They said, well, you have to turn the book in now, Dave. So I stopped going around. And I really never got to the northern part of the state. But the farthest north I got, I think, was Casadega, which is, if people have not heard of Casadega, it's worth a visit. It's the weirdest of all the places in Florida that I've ever been to. It is the weirdest one. It's the psychic capital of Florida, if not the world, if not the universe. And
we've got an episode in the archives all about Casadega, if anyone is interested in learning more.
And yet, as you pointed out in the book, they don't win the lottery all the time. What's up with that?
Casadega, wow. Did you spend a night? Either one of you, have you ever spent a night in Casadega?
No, I have not.
In their one hotel?
On a more serious note, you're a newspaper man. Craig's a newspaper man, and we've seen such a tremendous decline in the newspaper business, the number of newspapers, the size of newspapers, the importance of newspapers, the number of reporters and writers and journalists and editors. What is lost with the decline of newspapers over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, both, you know, for the state and nationally?
It's really sad. And it's mostly local news that's been destroyed. The national, you know, press still exists. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, they're still covering Congress and the presidency and the federal government. But as regional papers like the Herald, where I work, have declined, I mean, there's still, the people working at them are still really good. They're still good journalists and they're still doing amazing work, but there's about what, a fifth as many, literally, mm-hmm. as there used to be. There's just not enough reporters anymore covering the news. And so it's just not getting covered. And it's at the local level that you're feeling that the most. State government coverage, county government coverage, mm-hmm. you know, like here at the Herald, we have like, a few people trying to cover Dade County, which is, you know, a couple million people, and it's just, you can't do it. So that's been a terrible, terrible loss. And it's partly, this is going to sound like I'm blaming the readers, but I kind of am. Younger people, these kids today.
With their TikToks.
With their TikToks and their Instagrams and their,
yeah.
They're not consuming the way that, you know, when we were younger, everybody bought the paper. Now, why? Because there was no alternative. Maybe we would have been on TikTok too if it mm-hmm. existed, but it didn't. So we all bought the newspaper, which supported the newspaper, and we consumed it. You know, there it was.
Some people bought a newspaper twice a day, morning and
twice a day. Yeah, in the morning. Yes, God, those are really going back. But now, like, they just, even if when we put it there in front of them, they don't seem to want to consume it anymore. It's worrisome. I mean, it's really worrisome. Like, if all your news is coming from Twitter, you will get news. It's just, you won't get professionally, reported news, and you're more likely to get news you already agree with rather than be mm-hmm. challenged to look at a story that might give you some new information that might change your mind. And that really worries me.
The confusion of affirmation and information.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now you're running for president again. How many times have you run for president?
Oh God, I've lost track, but certainly more than anybody else alive. And I think that should count for something.
Sure.
And you're the, as far as I can tell, the only candidate with a sewer lift station named after you.
I am. I do have a sewage lifting station named for me in Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's lift station number 16. I'm not sure to this day why they lift their sewage in Grand Forks, North Dakota. I would leave it down there, but I've been there. They lift it. I think they're just bored. Anyway, I do have a sewage lifting station named in my honor, and that should count for something when we're deciding who should be the leader of this country.
Has it ever come to your attention of someone reading your work and you think, why in the world does that person want to read me, or think they have the time, or don't they have better things to do? I'm wondering if, you know, it's come to your attention, a celebrity, a politician, a president, someone of that nature reading your work, and you're like, good God, why?
Yeah, no, that I mean, I've over the years, of and I'm, it's very flattering. I'm sure it's happened to you as well, where you discover somebody that you admire is an admirer of yours. And that's like, whoa, like my best example probably is Steve Martin. Out of the blue, this is years ago, he wrote me a letter saying, I love your work. Hey, thank you for writing. So we started exchanging letters. Ultimately, he invited me to be one of the writers when he was a host of the Academy Awards in 2003. And then again, in 2010. And, you know, that's like a great feeling when you discover that.
Did he make you listen to him play banjo or anything? Well,
I have listened to Steve Martin play banjo many, many times. He's actually a very good banjo player.
Yeah,
unbelievable. I played. He had a guitar in his house. I stayed in his house when I was writing for the Academy Awards. He very great. I mean, I was his house guest, and it was lovely. And we would sit down. He had a guitar hanging on the wall in his living room. He has a beautiful house with art everywhere. We would play in the evening. He'd get out his banjo and I play the guitar. And at one point I look in the guitar and I can't remember specifically what the name, but I, he said, oh yeah, that's a, that guitar was given to me by Venema. And I looked it up and this guitar was worth a fortune that I, and I'm thinking like, I shouldn't even be touching this guitar.
Pete Townsend smashing the guitar.
No. But it was like, really, this is a nice guitar. You know, it's like a Stradivarius level guitar. So
did it elevate your playing?
I think I may have ruined the guitar. I'm afraid nobody will ever want to play it again because I put, you know, vibes into it.
I think we have to mention the and we did this before we started recording the Rock Bottom Remainders, the band that you started.
How did it get started?
Yeah, that was what I was. That's where I was at.
Well, when you go on a book tour, which is something we used to do a lot more of, but when you go from city to city, there would be all, what they called author escorts, who would pick you up at the airport, take you to your interviews, make sure you got to the hotel, make sure you got to the bookstore at night for your signing, make sure you got to the airport the next morning. That was their job. The woman who did this most in San Francisco was, her name was Kathy Goldmark. And she was also a musician. She played in bands, sang and everything. So when you went to San Francisco, Kathy would always take you around, but also if you had time in your schedule, she'd say, well, my band's playing tonight. You want to come, you know? So she, over the years of meeting various authors, she got to know which authors were into music and so on. And I had played in a rock band when I was in college. So, you know, we talked about music a lot. Anyway, in 1992, Kathy came up with this idea, which is at the American Booksellers Association convention. She was going to have a concert of authors who played, and she was going to form a rock band just for one night and raise money for a First Amendment Foundation charity. And so she sent a fax. This was the days of fax. Every author she could think of who had ever been in a car with her or even just she knew the fax number of and said, who would like to come to LA and be part of this band? We'll practice for a week and then we'll play a show. And basically everyone who answered yes to that fax became a part of the band. And Stephen King and Barbara Kingsolver and Matt Groening and Ridley Pearson, Roy Blunt, me, a bunch of us just, yeah, I'll do that. And that became the band. We came together to play for a week in LA. We were terrible, but the audience consisted of booksellers who had been drinking a lot. And when you get books, and you know, like Amy Tan and Stephen King are on stage, these are, you know, the people who sell a lot of books. It was like fun. It was just fun. And when we were leaving the stage that night, Stephen King said, "We're not done with this yet. We're going to do this again." He loved it. And so that
he's a horror author, you know.
He's a horror author. Yeah. Yeah. And if you think his writing is scary, you should hear him sing. So anyway, that was how the band started, and it never really died. And we just kept coming, you know, various mutation forms of it coming back. And we ended up playing for over 30 years. The last time we played was a couple of years ago. So people always say, are you still in existence? I don't know. If we came together, we tried to quit like 10 years ago, but we are such a bad band. We can't even quit.
Can't even do that, right? You know,
we can't begin or end songs on time, and we are unable to disband as a band on time. But that's where it started. That's where it came from.
Carl Heisen has complained that you never tell them what songs you're going to play before you play.
Well, in all my defense, even if you told Carl exactly what song you were going to play, he still would be unable to play it. You'll back me up on this.
Now I'm going to ask you guys told a story in Key West I had never heard before, which is the story about the gift Carl gave you for your wedding. I have to ask you about, because this is just quite amazing to me.
Yeah. When Michelle and I got engaged, Carl came to our house and he wrapped it and he put it in this box and he hands it to us. And, you know, then he leaves and we open it up and it's an egg. And like, you know, we had a rough idea maybe what kind of egg, because it's Carl. Carl is known to be a reptile enthusiast. Michelle, my wife, is not a big fan of reptiles. Like in general, if we have lizards in our house. I don't even know if lizards are reptiles, but you know, lizards we have down here. I have to get it out of the house immediately. So I asked Carl, I called him, I said, what is this egg you gave me? And he goes, well, that'll be a surprise, but you should definitely get a cage. So, like Michelle, and this I think was pretty smart on her part, put it in a refrigerator. And it never hatched. And that's, you know, that's kind of, Carl's still kind of angry at us for that, to be honest.
Well, you mentioned about Ridley Pearson. I have to ask you about your kids' books. My kids loved the books that you and Ridley Pearson wrote, Peter and the Starcatchers. They especially loved Science Fair, which was kind of a one-off, but that was a great one. What led you guys to do that? What prompted you to do?
Well, Ridley is the bass player in the Rock Bottom Remainders. He's actually a very good musician, and he's also a close friend. And our kids have become friends over the years. And one time we were at the Miami Book Fair. Ridley was staying at our house, and we're having breakfast. And he goes, "I was reading Peter Pan to Paige." His daughter's name is Paige, who is then 6 years old. Then reading Peter Pan to Paige, the original Jam Barry Peter Pan. And she stops me and goes, "How did Peter Pan meet Captain Hook in the first place?" And Ridley's like, "I don't know." So then he said, this is him talking to me at breakfast. So I have this idea, maybe write a prequel to Peter Pan. And I go, that's a pretty cool idea. I never thought of that. And he goes, would you want to write it with me? And I'm like, okay. You know, neither one of us had ever written a children's book, but Ridley was at the time in negotiations with Disney Publishing about another series of books. So he knew an editor there, and he approached her and said, Dave and I were thinking of writing this book about a prequel to Peter Pan, and would you be interested? And she said, yeah, we'd be interested. So we really did think it was going to be a little kid's book, maybe 50 pages long, aimed at little kids. But we really aren't little kid writers, you know. So we wrote kind of like the same way we'd write for grownups. And we plotted it out and everything. And it ended up being about a 500-page book, Peter and the Starcatchers, which was, we were a little nervous about that because it seemed like a big fat book. But at the time, the Harry Potter books were huge, and those are big fat books. And the publishing industry had kind of realized, hey, young people will read long books if they like the story. And so that became Peter and the Starcatchers, which did really well. And we ended up writing five of those. But it all started because of Paige's question to Ridley that morning. You know,
and it became a Broadway show, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. Right. Rick Ellis, the guy who wrote Jersey Boys, adapted it for the stage. And it's very different. I mean, we didn't understand how you could possibly make a Broadway show out of this this book. But he kind of reimagined it and brilliantly. And it became a Broadway show. It won, I think, 5 Tony Awards. It still plays as a student production all over the United States pretty regularly with Peter and the Starcatcher. It became Peter and Starcatcher with singular. I don't know why they changed the title, but.
And have you lined up a gig so the Rock Bottom Remainders provide the music for one of the productions?
No, fortunately, they want people to buy tickets, Craig, so they want people to actually go to see it.
Before we go, I just wanted to ask you one quick question, because I've heard you answer this, and I think it's just so charming. Where did you get your sense of humor from?
Oh, from my mom. I had a very funny mother. She was darkly funny. I grew up in the 50s. I was born in 1947, grew up in the 50s in suburban New York, and my mom was a housewife, which is what the moms were back then, and she had 4 kids, and she was busy all the time, schlepping us around doing, but she was like a different mom from the other moms. She had a very dark sense of humor, which at the time I did not think was that unusual. Like the example I always give is when my sister and I, there was a pond behind our house, and we would go to the pond, and my mom would open the window and yell, "Don't drown, kids!" And we go, "We won't." You know, we thought that was that was just like my mom's way of, you know, telling us not to drown, I guess. Anyway, but she was always that way. When we would go to, again, this is vivid memory, I'm with my mom and we're at Brissetti's Market in downtown Armonk, which is one block, Armonk, New York. She's doing the marketing, Ray Brissetti is behind the meat counter slicing bologna. And in comes my mom, you know, and you know, the other moms that are all shopping, and they all loved my mother. And so Ray would go, "How you doing, Marion?" And she'd go, "Just shitty, Ray." And, you know, and he would just crack and like, it was a good, she was different anyway. So my point was, my mom would, she would not take anything seriously. And, that's how we were raised. And when my dad died, we had a funeral, obviously, we had my dad's ashes in a box, and just the immediate family went to the cemetery to bury it, my dad. They had dug a hole. It was me and my sister and my two brothers and my mom. And it was raining, and we put my dad's ashes in a hole. We say some words, put some dirt over it. And we're all weeping and sad, and we're walking away in the rain. And I'm walking with my mom. She's got her arm in my arm. And she looks down at the other gravestones and goes, "So that's why we don't see him around anymore." and it was that was the way she was. She was, in my family, you were raised to never take anything too seriously and to see the humor in everything. And that was a gift, right? A gift I got from her. Everyone in my family kind of was that way. It was not till much later that I realized how different it was from, you know, other people's upbringings.
That's Dave Barry, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me,
guys. I'm looking forward to the memoir.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to finishing.
No pressure. No,
I should be writing it right now. I actually have been writing it while we've been talking. So.
Dude's a legend. You mean, think about the TV show, sitcom based on his life, when people watch network television, columns syndicated in 500 newspapers, Broadway show, 30 plus books.
What, and movies. They made a movie out of his first novel. Yeah.
And still going strong with the memoir. What an amazing, amazing career.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And truly an asset to Florida, a guy who clearly loves the state and defends it very strongly.
You think of the scope of that comic in 500 newspapers, and he wrote the column for something like 20 years. He's one of those like Jimmy Buffett stand-in figures for Florida. When people think of Florida, if it's sports, maybe it's Don Shula or Steve Spurrier or Bobby Bowden or someone like that. But, if you're not into it like that and you've read his newspaper column, you think Dave Barry, you think Florida, you think Miami, you think funny. And that gives a lot of positive associations, to this state.
Absolutely. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.